yesterday morning. I looked at my email, and there was an announcement that the new Sinai Temple website was up. SinaiTemple.org. It was designed by a company called Fluid Design and its CEO, Michael Schneider, and you can do all sorts of things with it. I have a list. You can listen to Rabbi Wolpe's latest sermon, or you can do that in person. You can check the Parsha, the candlelighting and Havdalah times, find out about services, schools, programs, classes, read the latest Sinai Speaks newsletter, use the calendar to check dates and times, and it says check back often, there's more to come. So I looked, and of course, such things still are a marvel to those of us who didn't grow up with them. And it seemed to me particularly poignant to look at not specifically Sinai Temple's website, SinaiTemple.org. I'm sure many of you were saying, what did he say again? What was it? So I had to just... But because of what I was going to talk about this morning, now, by the way, this afternoon, I was going to begin by telling you that 350 years ago, the first group of Jews came to America. On September 7th, which was the day that school started this year, here at Sinai Akiba, 1654, 23 Jews from Recife, Brazil, landed in New Amsterdam, which became New York. But being Jews, they didn't just take a trip. They were fleeing from the Portuguese Reconquista when they were captured by Spanish pirates in the Caribbean. They were rescued by a French vessel, to whom they had to pay considerable ransom, and the vessel dumped them in the Dutch colony of New Amsterdam. And that was the first group of Jews in North America. It was the 25th of Elul, right before Rosh Hashanah, and also, remarkably enough, September 11th. The very next year, the first significant Jewish event in America occurred. Asher Levy bought a house. And then he opened up a kosher butcher shop on what is now Wall Street. So we began, unsurprisingly, as refugees, but those two acts announced that Jews were here to stay. Yes, we know there may have been individuals who had traveled with Columbus under the cover of being conversos, those who had converted to Christianity, out of conviction or convenience, but this was the first community of Jews who identified themselves as Jews. 4 years after our arrival, in 1658, one of the original 23, named Bar Simon, was acquitted in the colony's civil court. And I want to read you what the judge said. Though the defendant is absent, yet no default is rendered against him, as he was summoned on his Sabbath. America was different. We all learned in school, or at least I hope we did, that Chaim Salomon financed the American Revolution some 80 to 90 years later. But what you may not know is that Salomon was in services on Shabbat when the request came to him directly from George Washington. And he stopped the services and took up essentially a collection. And when he had garnered money or pledges, they resumed the services. And when asked why he did it, Solomon uttered a line that should be known to every American Jew. He said, "Because it is our revolution too." And it was. It was different. In 1788 in Philadelphia, the national parade to celebrate the ratification of the Constitution, one division of the parade included all the prominent Christian clergy in the country, and walking hand in hand with them was one Rabbi Jacob Cohen. Fulfilling what was written in the Virginia Act for Religious Freedom, all shall be free to profess and argue by argument to maintain their opinions in matter of religion, and that shall in no wise diminish, enlarge, or affect their civil capacities. The author of those noble words was Thomas Jefferson. It was only a few years before that, in 1782, that Chazan Cantor Gershom Mendes Saxis wrote the first prayer for America that the Jewish people ever had. And some 80 years later, finally, a rabbi delivered the first prayer at the opening of a session of Congress. Don't forget that in the 1600s, the late 1600s, when that group of 23, big and small, as the sources tell us, that is, adults and children, landed here and made their lives in Europe, Jews were convulsed because of the Chmelnytsky pogroms. America was different. Because throughout our history, there was always a majority and the Jews. There were, through Europe, the Christians and the Jews. In Babylonia, there were Babylonians and Jews. In the Roman Empire, Romans and Jews. In the Muslim Empire, Muslims and Jews. But in America, there were no Americans and Jews. We were of the country, not apart from it. It doesn't mean that there weren't struggles. There were. You may know that at the beginning of the Civil War in 1861, a law was passed that demanded that all regimental chaplains be ordained of some Christian denomination. But America is different, because Rabbi Arnold Fischel came to President Lincoln himself and said, "This is unfair." Lincoln agreed, and it was the first legal victory for non-Christians since the founding of the country. You probably know that under Ulysses Grant in the same war, there was General Order 11, which expelled all Jews from the army's control of the Tennessee territories, and once again, a Jew named Caesar Caskell came with his congressman, John Gurley, from Cincinnati, and he came to see Lincoln. And the exchange that they had, which is reported in Jonathan Sarna's new book on American Judaism, tracing the 350 years, and by the way, Jonathan Sarna will be our guest at the library breakfast in December, if you want to hear it from him directly. Lincoln said to Caskell, "So the children of Israel were driven from the happy land of Canaan." And Caskell said, "Yes, and that is why we seek the protection of Father Abraham." To which Lincoln said, "And that protection you shall have at once," and countermanded Grant's order. By the way, in fairness to him, according to Grant, he was not aware of the order. At least that's what he said, that it was done by a subordinate, and I want to give him some credit. Ulysses Grant was the first sitting president to attend Jewish services, and he came with his entire cabinet. It goes on and on. Not perfect, not flawless, not a place where there were no instances of hatred or division or anti-Semitism, but what sprung from those 23 souls, big and little? Look around you. This is happening all over America this morning. It is remarkable. It is unprecedented in Jewish history. It is the greatest revolution in Jewish history since the destruction of the temple. Nothing before 1776 had happened like America. Now, there are Jews who don't feel the gratitude that they ought to America. That's true. But then the Midrash tells us that there were Jews who, as they were crossing the Red Sea when it split, didn't see the miracle because all they did was look down in the mud. Like any nation, America has mud. And if you keep your eyes only on the mud, you don't see the miracle. But all you have to do is lift your eyes from the mud and take a quick glance at the history of our people to know this is a miracle. And the heart of every Jew ought to swell with gratitude for this remarkable land. So the question is, what do we give back to our world, to our country, for what we've been given? A lot of Jews will talk about Jewish continuity and Jewish survival. Tomorrow, in fact, Rabbi Artzin in this sanctuary will talk about 350 years and the ways to keep the Jewish tradition alive in America. But survival is not enough. Survival is just communal Darwinianism. It's saying that we should survive because we should survive. We're better than that. Support of Israel is not enough. Israel needs us desperately. It needs our prayers and our purses and our presence. We will be talking later in the High Holidays about a trip that I hope you will join me and my family on around Passover, right before Passover of this year. Israel needs us, but even support of Israel is not enough. Jewish learning and observance are not enough. When Abraham first came to Canaan and sought to be accepted into that society, do you know what the Canaanites said to him? They didn't say, you can come because you're a nice person. They didn't say, you can come because you represent a good people. They said, Nisi Elohimata, you are a prince of God. You're an asset because you represent God in this world. We justify our existence by bringing something to the world, and that something is spelled out by the prophet. This is a world of great suffering and great pain. And as Isaiah says, Atem Edai, Neum Adonai, Va'ani El, you are my witnesses, said God, and I am your God. And according to the Midrash, to the rabbis, what that passage is saying is as long as we are God's witnesses, then God is God. But we can remove God from the world by ceasing to be witnesses. We owe something to the world, not just to the Jewish people. We have served this function often through history. And we have not always been loved for it, as you know. Maurice Samuel put it well. He said, of course the Jewish people haven't been loved. Who loves their alarm clock? But that is our mission, to be awake and to stir others who sleep to wakefulness. Along with the Jewish fear of being victims, there is a Jewish obligation to be witnesses to the sufferings that recently convulsed the Balkans and Somalia and Rwanda and Cambodia, to what is happening in the Sudan. Anywhere there is human pain, Jews ought to be witnesses. That's our job. Where there is grief and oppression and bereavement and loss and fear, we're called upon to be witnesses. That's what it means to be the Jewish people. I'll tell you something very interesting about Rosh Hashanah. If you look at the Greek calendar, it begins with the Olympics. The first Olympic Games begins the Greek calendar. If you look at the Christian calendar, it begins, as you know, with the birth of Jesus. If you look at the Muslim calendar, it begins with the travel of Muhammad. But when you look at the Jewish calendar, it begins with the creation of the world. It doesn't begin with Abraham. It doesn't begin with Moses. Because the world is bigger than us. And we owe the world just as we believe that the world owes us. Jews are obligated to feel connected to all. This is a congregation that is passionate about Israel, something of which we should be enormously proud. But there is a world ablaze out there. And it's not enough to care only about one thing. When Rabbi Fischel approached Lincoln in 1861, he had no idea what would happen. But we know. We stride the corridors of influence and of power. We have arrived in every sense of the word. And if we don't use our money and our influence and our tradition to make the world better, then we fail. We know what it is to suffer pain. Who knows better? A little while ago, I read the new novel by the Israeli author Aharon Meged, and in it, he begins one of his chapters with a chilling thought. He says, the novel is called Feigelman. It's about a Yiddish writer and the conflict between a Yiddish writer and a Hebrew writer. And in it, one of the chapters, he begins by saying, you know, everybody talks about Santayana's dictum, that those who don't remember history are doomed to repeat it. He says, but when I look at the history of the Jews, we remember it and still it repeats. We mourn and then we have to mourn again. But we are not the only ones. Others have suffered and they suffer. And if in America our history has changed, and it has, then we have to bring that hope in whatever way we think best to those whose history might change as well. It's not an easy task. In the words of Albert Camus, optimism is silly, but pessimism is cowardly. Every year, several times a year, we hear never again. Never again will we allow this to happen to the Jewish people. But never again can't only apply to Jews. I urge you to read yourself and give to your children a remarkable book called In My Hands, Memories of a Holocaust Rescuer. It's written by a woman named Irene Groot Updike. She was 17 years old when the war started. The terrible things that befell her, I won't recite to you now. You can use your imagination. But as a young Polish girl, when the Russians invaded, when she joined the resistance, she suffered, she saw her friends die. She was a girl. Except that on her own, single-handedly, she rescued 12 Jews by hiding them in the basement of the commandant for whom she was a housekeeper. And every day, she faced this man and gave him his breakfast, and eventually the relationship led to more than that, to which she submitted because she knew that those 12 Jews' lives depended on her. And when he left, she would run down and give them food. Day after day after day. It's a remarkable story. It deserves to be read by children along with Anne Frank. Not because there were so many like her. God knows there were pitifully few. But because we should be like her. Because we should care as she cared for people who are not of our people. Because our own difficulties and sufferings and worries and fears, as real as they are, should not, according to our tradition, blind us to the situation of the rest of the world. Atem Edai, you are my witnesses, said God. And if you look at the front page of the paper and then you just turn it, you're being a bystander, not a witness. Now I know some of you will assume at this point that I'm going to tell you who to vote for. Listen, I've gotten into enough trouble from the pulpit with other things. This isn't a political pitch. I am actually much less concerned who you vote for than that you pursue your convictions of your head and the highest promptings of your heart, and you let them lead you not only to poolside or to the tennis court or to the concert, but that you actively do something for tikkun olam, to make the world better. Rabbi Louis Siegel, an American rabbi, said the following, which I think puts it beautifully. You can look through our endless literature and find no spot where the Jew is told to look out for himself and not worry about anyone else. We're not allowed. You want to know what the Jewish response is? I saw it several days ago and it made me proud. The day after the massacre of the children in Russia by Chechen rebels, the day after, the Joint Distribution Committee sent out an email to everyone about how they could contribute through a Jewish organization to help the parents and the families who were injured and who had lost. That's a Jewish thing to do. And it's also a human thing to do. The first question in the Bible, I have repeated many times. God addresses to Adam, it is, Ayeka, where are you? And God doesn't mean a physical location, it is a spiritual location. But it was literally this morning, for the first time, that I realized that the answer to that question, where are you, is contained in the first question that a human being addresses to God in the Bible. The first question that a human being addresses to God is, Hashomer Achi Anochi, am I my brother's keeper? You know the answer to that question. It's yes. And when God says, Ayeka, where are you? You're supposed to answer both questions in one. I am here being my brother's keeper. Taking care of them. Making sure that they can live too. This is the decision we have to make, said Abraham Joshua Heschel. Whether our life is a pursuit of pleasure or an engagement to service. I don't have to tell you which it should be. This from a man whom, as you may know, linked arm in arm with Martin Luther King in the South and marched with him and came back to the Jewish Theological Seminary after the march and told his students, I felt that my feet were praying. We are God's witnesses. And we are not allowed to shut our eyes. Now that was it. I had finished the sermon. And this was, I think, 2 days ago. I was all done. I feel like saying I rolled the last sheet out of the typewriter, but the truth is the printer spat out the last sheet. And I was browsing through my library not looking for anything in particular, but I know Yom Kippur's coming soon. And I saw the back of a book shorn of its cover, and when I saw it, though I had not looked at it for 7 years since I put it in my library, I knew immediately what it was. And I pulled it off the shelf, and it was. When my father retired several years ago from his pulpit in Philadelphia, he dispersed his books to his children. And by some luck of the metaphysical draw, I got this one. I want to read you what it is. It is a celebration of the 250th anniversary of the settlement of Jews in the United States. It is the proceedings of the addresses delivered at Carnegie Hall 100 years ago, celebrating the 250th. So I immediately started to read the book, and I want to read you one selection and then finish with the prayer that the Jews finished with 100 years ago when they celebrated 250 years in America, not imagining the tumultuous and awful century that was to follow, but also not imagining the status and the comfort that we would attain in this blessed land. The first thing that caught my eye was the address by Reverend, because that is what they frequently called clergy, Dr. H. Pereira Mendes. Dr. H. Pereira Mendes was the leader of Sherit Yisrael in New York, a very prominent Sephardic Orthodox rabbi, and also was the man who was personally asked by Herzl to lead the American Federation of Zionists. Oh, marvelous destiny, a wonderful race. What does it all mean? What does this anniversary mean? A mere milestone in the march of eternities? What does it mean in the scheme of God for mankind's weal, since he is the God of all? What does it mean? You are my witnesses, said God. That is the answer. And then I knew that that was it. That it hadn't changed, not only in 100 years, but ever, that was our task. Edimatem, We are put here to be witnesses. And that is a sacred and a noble task. And this is the prayer with which I will close, with which they closed the proceedings 100 years ago to celebrate, as I said, the 250th, as we celebrate this morning the 350th anniversary of Jews in the United States of America. Our Father in heaven, who lovest all nations, all men are thy children. Thou dost apportion tasks to peoples according to their gifts of mind and heart, but all are revealing thy marvelous plans for mankind. May the day speedily dawn when thy kingdom will be established on earth and nations shall learn war no more, and peace shall be the crowning reward of a world redeemed by justice. And all shall know thee from the greatest to the least. Then shall loving kindness and truth meet, righteousness and peace kiss each other, truth spring forth from the earth, and righteousness look down from the heaven. May all hearts serve thee with one accord and recognize that thou art one and thy name is one. Amen.